There are many ways to go about identifying birds. Appearance, obviously, is one, but there are other ways as well. Larry Mueller here. Thanks again for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm looking forward to talking with our next guest, George Armistead. He is events coordinator at the American Birding Association, a research associate in the ornithology department at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University. And he's co-authored the book Better Birding, Tips, Tools, and Concepts for the Field, and joins us today. Maybe you have questions about birding or about birds. What do you do to find a specific bird? Join in our conversation today. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can also post your photos, bird photos, and questions on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, of course, The Larry Mueller Show. You can also reach us on Twitter at L. Mueller Show. And George, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be with you all today.
I tell you what, I have many bird books, and you can never have enough. And there are different approaches that people take, as authors take, in explaining their technique for observing birds. You talk about being a birder as opposed to a bird watcher at some point, I believe, in the book, that I thought was kind of fun. There is a difference between a birder and a bird watcher, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's a popular discussion among birders in particular, because I think there's a lot of overlap between the two, but I think I think most birders would agree that there's something a little bit more active about birding as opposed to bird watching. Bird watching, all birders are bird watchers as well. You know, we all enjoy just the sheer aesthetics of looking at birds and the beauty of birds, the wonder of birds, the strange things that they do at times. But we also, birders also sort of, there's an element of fanaticism in birding that doesn't probably quite exist in bird watching, where birders actually enter the field with active expectations about what they might see and even dream about what birds they might see. So I think that birders sort of take their love of birds to another level, and really are just a little bit more active about it than bird watchers. But you know, as I say in the book, I think both are very noble pursuits, and I would never sort of advocate one above the other. They're both equally good things to be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I really am more a bird watcher, and I've learned that by going out with birders.
Yeah.
You go out with a birder, and I've soon learned that I know nothing compared to these people.
Well, I always say that whether you're a bird watcher or a birder, I think the most important thing is to enjoy it. Watching birds is a wonderful break. You get to just sort of be present in the moment, forget about everything else that may be going on, all the stresses, the crazy political campaigns, or how your sports team may not be doing as well as you might like, and you get to just say, you know what, I'm just going to watch this bird. It doesn't care about any of that stuff. It's just living its life, and that can be a real pleasurable, relaxing thing to do.
Oh yeah, you know, this time of the year for me, it's so I so enjoy this time of the year. I get out a lot. Every day I do a 3-mile jog and so forth, and one of my favorite birds, I can see right at the top of, if I hear the cardinal.
There it is.
Yeah, there it is. I hear that cardinal, and I know that I can look. I look immediately to the top of the tree.
Uh huh.
Because that's where you're going to find it.
Yep, they like a good prominent perch where they can belt out that song and let everybody know that this is their spot. A little bit of sun is all it takes, and they get pretty riled up and ready to sing.
Oh, I heard one this morning on the way in, on my travel across my normal jogging route, and I thought, oh, it's such a pleasure. And now there aren't leaves on the tree, so you can actually see. It's a good time to be out there, actually.
Yeah, this is a good time of year for that. But, you know, the spring is really, I think, There's all sorts of birds to see all year long, but spring is like you're like a kid in the candy store. You know, every day there's new stuff, and especially by the time late April and May hit,
May,
it's just, you know, sort of an explosion of color and sound, and it's, you never know what you're going to find every day, but you know you're going to find something really, really cool. And that's just starting up right now, as you say, as things start to warm up, as the sun starts to come out a bit more. You see, birds know it's coming. As the daylight lengthens, they have hormones that are activated. They start singing more and start claiming territory. So we're just starting to see hints of that right now.
What mistakes do beginning birders tend to make when looking for birds?
Well, I think I'd say a couple things. I think it can seem very overwhelming. You know, nature, you go outside, if you haven't spent a lot of time outside or you haven't spent a lot of time looking at birds, it can just seem like there's so much going on that you don't know where to look first. And as my colleague Bill Stewart at the American Birding Association likes to say, start anywhere. You know, don't worry too much about trying to see everything. You know, just focus on one bird or a couple birds and you know, try to see what it's doing. I think a lot of birders, when they're starting out, you know, we focus in on color. And that's, of course, an important thing in a lot of bird identification. But often we talk about in the book sort of wide-angle birding, you know. And if you get too tuned into what's going on in your binoculars or your telescope, you can lose sight of what's going on around the bird. And just seeing how it behaves, seeing the site that it's chosen to hang out in, what it's eating, what other birds it might be interacting with. You know, I'd say, you know, don't try to do too much. Just try to, you know, appreciate a single bird at a time and take it from there. If you try to see everything at once, it just gets overwhelming fast. As I say, the whole idea with this is it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah, it is. And keeping an open mind, you had a great line in your book. What was it? When you hear hoofbeats, think horses, but consider zebras.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, because that's one of the wonderful elements about bird watching and birding is that, you know, there is this element of discovery. You set out your front door, and you never know what you're going to find. I mean, you know, you have a reasonable chance. Like, you've got your cardinal. You know, I got my red-tailed hawk that I see pretty routinely, and it's like we're old friends. We just sort of nod at each other as we're walking down the street. And that's a great element of birding, too, is sort of checking in with old friends almost, you know. But the other side of it is there's this element of discovery, which you can never predict. You might go outside and might see something you just never, ever, ever expect, and the wonder and rush you get from those moments are exhilarating.
Absolutely. Linda in Madison has a comment. Linda, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. My mom witnessed about a week ago one, possibly two pair of sandhill cranes circling the same area over and over, and we were just kind of curious exactly why they were doing that, and I'll take my answer off air.
Okay, so a pair circling and circling and circling.
Yeah.
There they are.
Great sound, too. All the cranes make amazing sounds. All the world's cranes have wonderful, wonderful vocalizations, and they have really wonderful ritualized courtship displays that you may get to see, because if they're, you know, a lot of cranes are on the move right now.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what part of Wisconsin you're in. There may be a few pairs breeding nearby, but this is a time of year where a lot of people go to the Platte River in Nebraska, because there'll be many, many thousands of sandhill cranes gathering and departing for points north where they will breed. So that pair that's flying overhead, they may be in migration on their way out, or they could hang around. And you might actually have a nesting pair. That would be very lucky, but it's possible. So
we are loaded with sandhill cranes in this state right now.
Is that right? Yeah, it's pretty much peak migration for them now. Into early April is a big, big time for them. And yeah, if you're lucky, you might get to see them doing their crazy courtship dance. It's quite a spectacular thing to see.
And they're circling. They're probably that circling is maybe they're. Maybe it's an area they want. Maybe there was something down there that was bothering them, that they were just waiting. You never know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. say, they could be scoping it out, prospecting, as it's called. They might be prospecting, saying, you know, this looks like a spot where we could set up shop. You know, maybe we would nest here, or maybe they're just thinking, is that food or not? You know, and they could be looking at it like, we might want to go down there and see if we can get some grub, or they might be thinking about, you know, nesting, and so they're probably checking things out, deciding what they want to do.
Yeah. Sue in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Sue. Thanks for calling.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I was calling up about the bluebirds that have just arrived in Wausau on the 16th and 17th of this month. And my question for you is, do the males come up like the robins first, or is it the males and the females? And the question is, in regards to, I'm always surprised that they stay in our front yard, but when the first arrivals, they come to the backyard where the trees have not put on leaves yet, but they will never be seen there again during the rest of the season.
Interesting.
That is interesting, yeah. You're right that very often with our songbirds, and bluebirds are in the thrush family, just like robins. They're in the same family as the robins. And with most of our songbirds, that is the way that it works. You know, mostly it's the males that sing. You know, the females are the ones that do the choosing, by and large, with songbirds and with most birds even, is the females choose their mates in part based on a male's fitness. And a big part of a male's fitness usually is its song. So many times with songbirds, a male goes, you know, stakes out a territory and starts singing, trying to impress females that might be coming by.
And on that note, we got to take a quick break. Oh, this is so much fun talking today with George Armistead about his book, Better Birding. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking today with George Armistead about his new book he co-authored with Brian Sullivan. It's called Better Birding, Tips, Tools, and Concepts for the Field. He has lots of experience in this area. He coordinates the American Birding Association events. He's a research associate in the ornithology department at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University. And as I said, co-authored this book. He's led birding tours on 7 continents. Wow. Have you found a rare bird? I have a question about birding or a question about his book, Better Birding. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And George, before we go back to the phones and our callers, I'd like you to talk about the book, how it's organized. You've got some outstanding color photography in the book, and I make sure you talk about that as well.
I'm indebted, of course. Brian and I both are indebted to the many photographers we relied on for the imagery. Most of the imagery, a significant portion of it, is actually Brian's. Brian Sullivan. He is a tremendous photographer, and has been organizing photo collections for a very long time. So he was. I often like to say Brian was the looks of the book and I was sort of more of the voice, but the truth is it was a real collaborative effort and we really edited each other's work significantly. But yeah, we have, you know, we have an introductory section where we discuss various points of birding, how one might use an understanding of taxonomy and molt, which are two subjects which often sort of bore people to tears, but we thought they were worth discussing because one can actually learn a lot about birds from them, and we talk about using playback and some other things. And then we have the bulk of the book, which is 24 chapters, which are groups of birds. So we have one on swans and white herons and a bunch of other groups as well. And the idea was to provide a foundation by which people can approach field identification to each of these groups. Some of the approaches are similar between chapters, and others are quite different.
Well, it's a really fascinating book to look through, and your writing style is very engaging, and that obviously helps as well. It's a nice read.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah, really nice read. Roxy in Costco has something for us. Let's go to her. Roxy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. I live in rural Kewaunee County, and I have a horse corral at the end of our property, and the end of our property has a little waterway and a tree line, a fence tree line. And I was checking my horse fencing, and I thought I heard a kitten. So I started to check the brush and followed that tree line, and it seemed like that kitten was just kind of ahead of me. Never found a kitten, so I'm assuming, after I told some people about this, they said they think it's a bird. So what was I hearing?
Wow, so it was sort of a mewing sound, sort of.
Yeah.
Well, there's a number of possibilities, and I'm not sure that I could be certain what it is exactly, but, you know, of course, mockingbirds can issue a bunch of different sounds. They can imitate dozens and dozens of different birds, and often they are fairly conspicuous, but at times they can be sort of retiring in hedgerows and brushes. There are sounds that birds like towhees give that they're often are described as sort of mewing sounds like that. I imagine you're not really at a great time of year for something like a catbird, which actually can sound, you know, unsurprisingly like a cat, but I wouldn't expect one there at this season. So I sort of doubt it was that. But the catbird is in the same family as the mockingbird, and they can both imitate a variety of sounds. So I guess mockingbird would be my guess, but it's a sort of a tough call this time of year.
Yeah, not a bad guess. Victor in West Allis has something for us, too. Victor, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm curious about what Joe's opinion. My wife and I love photographing birds and everything else in wildlife. We occasionally come across a rare one that migrated accidentally. And my question is this, because we've seen the horrors when it is notified. Would he put it on a bird blog right away, Sphere, and then tell the whole world, and then before you know, you have like 500 birders and photographers coming, or would he keep it to himself?
Yeah, that's a real issue for folks when they find something unusual. I think a good practice would be to find out who your nearest local bird club is and contact one of the officers of the clubs there. If I'm understanding your question right, you're asking what would one do in that situation if you find something rare, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I would do, is because, you know, it's hard to say. Sometimes you find a rare bird and hardly anybody really shows up for it. And other times, you know, it can turn into quite a zoo. I think that would be the way to go. It would be to contact the local bird clubs, contact one of the officers there, and see what they suggest, because a lot of times they'll know how to handle a situation like that.
Sometimes you can, well, you can also report on eBird, for example. If you go there, you don't have to give the exact location, but it's nice for people to know.
That's true, yeah. I mean, generally, I'm in favor of sharing bird sightings, unless it is something that's really going to attract a massive crowd, and then you have to consider private property and how sensitive the bird might be and so forth. And sometimes you eBird something, and all of a sudden you're deluged with questions about it, but that's very rare. Typically, you eBird something, and the eBird reviewer will get in touch with you, and that's a very good way to go about getting the word out.
Tom in Algoma, thank you for calling.
Hi, yes, Larry. Got a question for your guest. Dovetails in with the previous question, sort of. Actually, there are two. First off, what was the rarest bird he has seen, and where was the location? And number two, what are his two most favorite birds?
Oh.
The answer off the air.
All right, thanks.
Those are good questions. I think probably the rarest bird I've ever seen was in New Zealand. So we're going outside the United States here.
Sure.
A bird called the magenta petrel, or the taiko. I saw it in 2007 at sea, well south of New Zealand. And I remember I was hoping to see it in the region, but I didn't think I would. And luckily, there's about five of us on the boat that day that did see it and got some pictures of it. Only about 100 of those birds left in the world, so that was an incredible thrill. As far as favorite birds go, I always say that picking a favorite bird is sort of like picking a favorite song or a favorite beer. There are so many good ones to choose from, it's hard to really to be certain. But I would say generally seabirds, meaning like albatrosses, storm petrels, petrels. Those, to me, the petrels in particular in the genus Pterodroma, to me, they're sort of like the Ferraris of the bird world. They have nice streamlined shapes, and they zip around incredibly. So I really like them.
Very good. Thank you. Thanks so much, Tom, for that question. Appreciate it. We have, what's your list like? What's your life list like?
Mine is up to, I think for the U.S., for the ABA area, as we call it, the U.S. and Canada combined, mine's in about the 730s or so.
Oh.
So it's, you know, it's up there, but there's people now that have close to 900. I think there's two people now that have 900. So those people have really dedicated their time to trying to see all the birds in the ABA area.
One of my favorite books that I really enjoyed reading was The Big Year.
Oh, it's a great book, yeah, by Mark of Masick. Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to be able to interview Mark on the show, and we just had a marvelous time. And that
he's a great storyteller.
Oh,
wonderful job with that book.
Yeah,
great read.
Wonderful job with it. Well, Tom, thanks again. Virginia in Green Bay, we'll turn to you next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I would like to know how to keep small peckers off your cedar siding.
Right.
This comes up a lot on the show.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Georgie, cedar siding.
Yeah, you know, this is a problem I've heard a lot about, and I haven't heard a lot of solutions for it. I've heard about people, you know, putting sort of, you know, various things along their house to try to deter birds. You know, some people will put up those decoy owls. And that's sort of a less invasive way than some others. That might be as good as anything as I might recommend would be to, you know, put up one of these decoy owls and see if that doesn't spook them off.
Sometimes people will hang webbing or of some sort over the areas where the birds may have been active, and
that sometimes will work. Like some wind chimes or something, or some kind of webbing or sort of long stuff that, you know, would get in their way a little bit, but wouldn't injure them.
Right.
And that would be an effective thing as well.
Thanks, Virginia. Tina in Oxford, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for having me. Just two comments that over the years I've run across. When we lived in Muskego a few years ago over there, behind the house there was this beautiful bird song I had never heard before. And walked back in the woods back there, and it was hard to spot right away, but finally on the edge of a bough over there was this wood thrush. I've never seen a wood thrush since then. It's a big bird. It's speckled brown and white, bigger than a robin, and it was singing its most beautiful song. It allowed me to get almost within arm's length of it, and it kept singing, and I was just dumbfounded that it allowed me to get that close, and when I looked down, its mate was down on the ground, deceased.
Wow.
It just was a haunting situation. You know, I just never got it out of my memory.
Wow. That's one of the most beautiful bird songs in the country, the wood thrush, one of the most beautiful songsters that we have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was it off migrate? I've never seen one in Wisconsin since then.
Huh.
Well, there are, if you go to eBird, you go to the site, the website, you will see if there have been other sightings of wood thrush and where they were in Wisconsin.
Yeah, eBird's a great tool for that. You can go into the Explore data feature, type in your location, and it'll generate a map that shows you, the area, the sightings in the area. That'd be a good first place to check would be the eBird.org website.
Yeah, thanks, Tina, for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Vivian in Green Bay up next. Hi, Vivian. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi. I have a question about pileated woodpeckers, and there's some controversy among my friends because pileated can certainly damage a tree, and I witnessed this on some property in northern Wisconsin. 30 feet up, there was one continuous chipped-out cavern, and the flesh of the tree was quite white and blondish. Then beyond the 30 feet, there were several caverns that had not yet been connected, but the oblong hole. And I was trying to figure out, were they looking in there for insects in what appeared to be a healthy tree, or why such extensive damage from the roots of the tree 30 feet up and then beyond.
Wow, yeah, that sounds like a pretty unusual situation.
Yeah.
As it sounds like, as you're well aware, the Pileateds can make some pretty amazing excavations, but that sounds even beyond what you would expect normally. I mean, yes, usually they're digging for one of two reasons. They're either trying to set up a nest or they're looking for food. And more often, they're looking. If they're looking for food, it's either a tree that is got a bunch of parasites, or it may be on its way out. It may be a tree that's in not very good shape. So why it would make a bunch of excavations from sort of the ground level up suggests to me that it's probably food related.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm almost positive. It'd be food related. They're after insects.
Even in what looked like a healthy tree?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if it's infested with larvae, then they probably make a good day out of it or two.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Here's a sound that I enjoy hearing. Oh, man.
That's one of the... The common loon,
and it's this time of the year, or just now, in coming pretty soon, throughout the entire state of Wisconsin, we'll be hearing and seeing loons, even in southern Wisconsin on one of our Madison lakes. You might find up to 100 loons on their way north to the northern part of the state where they're doing their nesting.
And they're getting cranked up this time of year too, ready to vocalize just like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's one. I don't think you have a photo of this one in this owl, but...
That's a fantastic one. The Who Cooks for You? Who Cooks for You All, as they say it says. The barred owl. Yeah, that's another one of my favorites up there with the wood thrush. Fantastic songster, the barred owl. They can really, really get cranked up and hold forth.
Absolutely. Tara in Lansing, Iowa has something for us. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I live in a wonderful area here, right on the Mississippi River, a great flyway. I've only lived here about 3 or 4 years, have been into bird watching. But very fortunately, I just wanted to say, like, I'm fluffing my own feathers here. I've already, in the last couple years, have had two rare bird sightings.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, I had a visit from it took a while to get the ID down, but a leucistic yellow-bellied sapsucker.
Wow.
That was very
That's rare.
Bird.
Well, that's in Lansing, Iowa.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one really took everyone. This was what I believe on the ABA, the rare bird alert, a lark bunting.
Oh, wow. Those are two great birds. Yeah, leucistic sapsucker would be, that, I imagine that would throw everyone for a loop because leucistic basically means it's lacking melanin. So a bird all of a sudden looks just completely different than it normally would. And lark bunting, that's a sharp-looking bird, too. I'm sure that would attract some folks.
Yeah, I did after I was on the Facebook ID.
Yeah.
I have a bird ID site, and I put those pictures on there, and, oh, they just went crazy.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, it's always exciting. In Wisconsin, the last couple of years, George, we've had an infusion of snowy owls.
Yes, yeah, a couple big winters in a row, especially not last winter, but the winter before was a huge, almost unprecedented invasion of snowy owls. They had a bumper crop up there in the Arctic, and basically the lower 48 was flooded with them the following winter. It was an exciting thing.
Absolutely. Ron in Buffalo, thank you for calling. Hello.
I was calling. I was on my way to work one day, and I was going across the top of a bluff, and the power line that actually crosses the road.
and we were losing you as a power line and saw a hawk. The hawk, I can tell from Jill's helping me out here a little bit, sort of a darkish or black body with a red tail.
Uh-huh.
And likely a red tail.
Yeah, a hawk with a red tail, that's very likely the red-tailed hawk, which is one of our most, it's one of our largest raptors and one of the most common roadside hawks you see. They love preying on mammals, small mammals like squirrels and rabbits. So they love roadsides and often sit out showing their nice brick red tails. The adults have red tails. The youngsters have sort of browner tails, but the adults have nice red tails.
Yeah, and they're really a pretty bird. And you're right. That's something that you get on the road and drive, and you don't have to drive very far. In this state, anyway, before you see a red tail.
That's right. Yeah.
Along that. We have Tom in Waterloo with a question. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Larry. Say, the last couple of weeks at my bird feeder, which is right outside my kitchen window, with the juncos, the gray-slated junco that are so common, I've seen another, what appears to be a junco that's got a very dark or black head and shoulder area. And I looked in my Stokes Field guide, and they say something about an Oregon. They call it Oregon.
Yeah. Oregon junco, yeah. That's a possibility. I mean, that would be an unusual bird where you are, but certainly not impossible. And, you know, we on Facebook, the ABA, the American Birding Association, we have a page called What's This Bird? If you can get a picture of it and post it there, we have folks that can identify it very quickly. But, yeah, if it's got sort of a real nice dark hood and then sort of a browner back, that could be an Oregon junco. Or juncos are real confusing because basically they especially out west, in the east we only have one, but sort of west of the Great Plains, there's sort of different populations that look different, and there are some intergrades between populations that can look sort of between, you know, say an Oregon or a pink-sided or some of the other ones. But, yeah, an Oregon junco is a possibility where you are. If you can get a picture of it, that would be really great.
Be wonderful. Tom, thanks a lot for calling, Tom. And, George, how's your book doing, by the way?
It's doing good. I think I checked. I've been traveling a lot lately. But prior to, you know, up till about 6 weeks ago or so, we were selling a good number of copies, and people were responding well to it. So, we're excited about the way things are going. And Brian and I both have got a number of speaking engagements, you know, coming up at various bird clubs and bird festivals around the country. So hopefully we'll have a chance to visit with folks all over the place.
I hope you make it to Wisconsin. It'd be great to see you here.
That would be great. I haven't been to Hurricane Marsh since I was a little kid, and I would love to get back there.
Oh, yeah. It is, it is a real treasure, George, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place to be. And you've got a great book here. Thank you so much for coming by and talking with us about it. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was great speaking with you, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, George Armistead, our guest today, he authored this book with Brian Sullivan, and the book title is Better Birding, Tips, Tools, and Concepts for the Field. It's a wonderful book published by Princeton University Pressed, and I know you're going to have fun. I'm hanging on to that one, and hopefully we'll have a chance to have him back to be with us again. I wanted to ask him, I forgot to ask him if he is related to the Armistead of Civil War fame. If I have him on again, or when we have him on again, I will ask that question. He probably gets asked that question all the time. The spelling's the same. Tomorrow. Oh, we're going to have some fun tomorrow because we're going to be talking about baking and baking Easter breads. And Paul Novak's probably coming by with a little Easter bread for me to chomp on while we talk about it. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.